So, Hebrews 11, again, we've been working our way through this wonderful chapter, the letter to the Hebrews. As we start this evening, I want to ask you a question to think about. Do you know the answer to this question? Someone says to you, does faith give you a comfortable life? What would you say to someone? If you were going to give a defense for your hope, and someone asked you, does faith give you a comfortable life? What would you say, I wonder? Well, I would say no. No, it doesn't. Faith doesn't give us a comfortable life, necessarily. But here's another question that you might want to answer if someone asks you the first question. Does faith give you comfort in life? Does faith give you comfort in life? Well, yes. It does. And Abraham proves the truth of both of those answers. Does faith give you a comfortable life? No. Does faith give you comfort in life? Yes. Because of Abraham's faith in God, he experienced a great amount of discomfort in his life. He had a very uncomfortable life. But because of his faith in God, Abraham experienced great comfort during his life as he looked forward to what God had promised him. Now, it's not surprising in a chapter all about faith that the writer to the Hebrews draws our attention to Abraham. Now, some people in this chapter you think are quite surprising that they're there, but Abraham, well, you expect him to be there in a chapter on faith. He's probably the greatest example of faith in the whole Bible. And no person in history would have been more familiar to the Hebrew Christians than Abraham. From the time that they were toddlers, they would have learned about their great ancestor, Abraham. But now, these Hebrew Christians were struggling with the hardness of following Jesus. And they were longing for a more comfortable life. And they were being tempted away from Christ. They were being tempted to live as though Jesus had never come. And so the writer, along with the other examples in this chapter, he points them back to this familiar figure. Think again about Abraham. How was it that he lived for God? You need to exercise faith in the same way that Abraham did. Abraham had to trust God when God gave him promises about things he couldn't see. He would, in fact, never see in his own lifetime, some of them. What did God promise to Abraham? Two main things: land and people. God promised Abraham a new homeland. And God promised Abraham a nation to live in that homeland, a nation made up of his own descendants. And this evening we're going to focus mainly on the first of those, on the land promise. And next time, God willing, we'll think more about the people. So God promised Abraham land and people, and we're going to be thinking about land this evening. Just like the Hebrew Christians, we need to follow in the footsteps of Abraham's faith. And I want to point out three lessons about faith from this passage in front of us this evening. Three lessons, here they are, I'll give them beforehand so you'll know where we're going. People of faith leave their old life behind. People of faith live as foreigners on earth. And people of faith look forward to a city to come. So that's where we're going. So the first of those, people of faith leave their old life behind. And here we're looking at verses 8 and 15. Verse 8 of Hebrews 11. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. So here was Abraham, living the life he was used to. And suddenly, everything changed. God told him to leave where he was and to go to a different place, and God didn't even tell him where that place was. He didn't know where he was going. Now, Abraham grew up in one of the leading cities of the world at that time, Ur of the Chaldeans, as it came to be known. It's in what is now southern Iraq. And Ur, in those days, was a thriving and sophisticated city. It was a port city on the river Euphrates, and in those days the Persian Gulf came further up towards Ur than it does today. And there is archaeological evidence that it traded with places as far away as India. I think they found some ebony in there, which came from India, special wood that grew in India. And it's in records as well. They found that they traded with places in the Indus Valley, what we now call India. And at that time, at the time of Abraham, it's thought that over 60,000 people lived there. That's an enormous city for those days. Some of them lived in large palatial residences, wealthy merchants and so on. They had foreigners' quarters for people coming into the city, perhaps on ships and so on. It was a very sophisticated place. They had residential streets. They had a very highly developed urban life. They had a strong culture. They were technologically advanced. They enjoyed music and craftsmanship and art. And you can, in fact, go to London, the British Museum. There you can see some beautiful objects that were recovered from Ur by archaeologists. And you can go and see them in the British Museum. Musical instruments, other beautiful things that you can see on display. And they kept very careful written records. They used to write on clay tablets in a kind of writing called cuneiform, which was the wedge-shaped script made by printing sharp sticks into clay tablets and then baking the tablets. And people have found whole libraries of these tablets from places like Ur going back. And you can get a view of what their daily life was like, because they've been able to translate this writing by comparing it with other languages that people know. And Ur had a well-defined legal system. It had a very well-organized bureaucracy. In fact, the oldest surviving law code comes from Ur-Nammu, who was king of Ur. So it was quite an amazing ancient city. But Ur was also a city of idolatry. It was devoted to the worship of a moon god, the moon god of the Babylonians. And there was a huge temple or ziggurat, a bit like that we imagine the Tower of Babel was. And archaeologists uncovered this ziggurat in the early 20th century. You can still see it today. Yes, the upper levels were reconstructed by the Babylonians later on. And in recent times, even Saddam Hussein did his own renovations and built a staircase so you can get to the top of it. But the basic foundation and the first level comes from the old Ur, even of going back to Abraham's time. Well, here's what Joshua said about Abraham's background when he was giving a speech to the people of Israel hundreds of years later, Joshua 24, the only real clue we have from the Bible history of what Ur was like. But it says that Joshua said this to the people of Israel. It said, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times." That's the river Euphrates. "And they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout all the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac." That's Joshua 24, verses 2 and 3. It wasn't that Abraham's family had no knowledge of the one true God. If you look at Genesis 11, you can see in the genealogy there, the family tree in Genesis 11, that they were descendants of Shem, Noah's son Shem. And you can work out, if you do the sums quite easily, that Shem was still alive for many decades after Abraham was born. But despite the knowledge that they had in their family in the past, Shem's descendants had obviously begun to worship idols. And it's against this backdrop that God's call came to Abraham. And he had to leave behind all that he was familiar with without knowing where he was going to end up. He had to give up the sophisticated city life for the life of a nomad. He had to, instead of living in well-built houses, he had to live in tents He had to exchange a life of luxury for a life of hardship. And so Abraham left Ur. And first of all, he travelled to Haran. If you've got your maps, you can see that along the Euphrates River from Ur, going northwest towards Haran, which is in modern-day Turkey. 600 miles or so he travelled. It seems that he stayed there several years, and his father had gone with him as far as that. In fact, in Genesis 11, it makes it appear that Terah is taking Abraham, but you read other places, and it seems that God had given Abraham the message to leave. But Terah went as far as Abraham. And after his father died, Abraham then travelled another 500 miles plus southwest to Canaan, as you can see on your map, going towards Shechem there, passing through Syria as we know it today. Damascus was around then, and so on. And this is how Stephen, in Acts 7, when Stephen spoke to the Jewish leaders of New Testament times, Acts 7, Stephen said this about Abraham's journey. He said, "The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, before he dwelt in Haran, and said to him, 'Get out of your country and from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you.' Then he came out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land in which you now dwell. And God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on. But even when Abraham had no child, he promised to give it to him for a possession and to his descendants after him." Acts 7, verses 2 to 5. Well, God's call to Abraham, we read out there at the beginning of Genesis chapter 12, God's call to Abraham, as recorded there. It's a little unclear whether that was the original call that he received in southern Mesopotamia, in Ur, or God's repeated call in Haran. But in any case, the message is the same, and Abraham's response was the same. When God said, "Move," Abraham moved. Immediately he obeyed, up sticks, and left. And this is what God said to Abraham in Genesis 12, beginning of Genesis 12. He said, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So that's the background from the Bible history in various different places. We can piece it together, the jigsaw. But let's come back to Hebrews. The writer summarizes all of that in just two sentences. He expects people to know that background he's writing to, because they're Jewish Christians. And he summarizes it all in just two sentences. He says there in verse 8, "By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going." So what's the writer's point? What's the point he's making through Abraham? His point is, as with all the other people in this chapter, that Abraham had to live by faith. Not by what he saw around him, but by faith, by believing God's promises. All Abraham had was God's word to him, God's message to him. And because of that message from God, he immediately obeyed, left his home, left behind his home, most of his extended family, and his comfortable life. To people around him, that would have seemed very strange, wouldn't it? "Why, Abraham, are you doing this? You have such good job prospects here in Ur. Look, you're son of a wealthy citizen. You've got amazing, you're a good businessman. You're already pretty wealthy. And look, you could make millions if you stayed here in Ur. There are incredible opportunities for trade. It's the best place, city in the whole world for entrepreneurs and for traders. You should stay here, Abraham." But Abraham obeyed God. He was prepared to leave all that behind and to rough it because he believed what God told him. He was determined to follow the one true God and not the idolatry that was so popular all around him. So let's bring it home to us. What is God's command to us? God hasn't told us that we must leave behind our houses, pack our belongings, and become travellers living in tents, moving from or going from youth hostel to youth hostel through the country. But God has told us to go on a journey of faith. He's told us about an inheritance that we can't yet see. And God has called us to believe in Jesus and to follow him. John 8, verse 12. Jesus spoke to them again, the people around him, and said, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." He's saying to everyone, follow me. That's the key to life. Follow Jesus. John 10, verse 27, Jesus said, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." Matthew 16, verse 24, Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" So he's saying, get your priorities right. And really, it's a continuation of what God had said to Abraham. Abraham was following by faith, and Jesus calls us to live by faith, to make some surprising choices, to leave behind some of the things that we could have in order to follow Jesus. And we see that. You could give many other examples from the New Testament. Jesus said, in fact, in Luke 14, there's a whole extended section there where Jesus is talking, Luke 14, 25 to 32, and he concludes it by saying, "Whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." Now, he's not saying, again, that we have to leave our houses, but he's saying if you love those things and you want to cling on to those things at all costs, even when that means going against what I say, then you've made the wrong choice. You can't be my disciple. There's no sign that you are a child of God, that you're living by faith like Abraham did. Well, the Hebrew Christians were being tempted to look fondly back to their old life, and they were thinking how much easier it would be if they could only go back and live like everyone else in their community around them was doing. And we're tempted in similar ways. We face pressure, perhaps at work, to conform to the culture around us. And we need to remember Abraham, to follow what God has told us rather than what apparently makes sense to the world around us. The world will think we're strange for doing that. But we know what God has said, and what God has said is true. And we need to believe it like Abraham did. So have you left your old life behind yet? I wonder, is there anyone here who hasn't left behind their old way of life? You've heard God's message many times in this church, or perhaps at home from your parents or through friends, and you haven't left behind your old way of life yet. Yes, you know what God has said, you know what Jesus has said, follow me, but you want to live your own life for yourself, and you just want to delay a bit longer. Well, are you resisting and delaying because you love this world and because you want to be popular with your friends and to be well thought of by others in this world? Are you prepared to follow Christ and go his way? Well, are you a Christian who is being tempted away from Christ, tempted to go back into the world because of the hardness of life? Maybe people in your family making life a misery for you because you're a Christian, or maybe it's just the difficulties that you're facing and you perhaps feel a bit hopeless at times and you wonder what it's all about. Well, you need to get back to thinking like Abraham did. Remember Abraham. People of faith leave their old life behind. But then, secondly, people of faith are foreigners on earth. people of faith are foreigners on earth. Verse 9. By faith, Abraham dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. Abraham travelled from place to place in the land of Canaan. We saw some of the beginnings of his travellings, even as we read in Genesis 12 there, how he travelled from one place to another place, built an altar here, went on further, built an altar to the Lord, worshipped the Lord there. He had no permanent place to stay. He was living as a foreigner in the land. One day the land would belong to him and his descendants. That's what God had told him. But for now, he was living as a foreigner in it. God had promised it to him, but he didn't yet own it. It was his inheritance, but he didn't possess it. And for now, the kingdoms of the Canaanites still ruled. But it was 25 years after Abraham left Haran that finally the promised son came. Isaac was born when Abraham was 20, and still they were living in tents. Isaac lived in a tent throughout his life. His son Jacob, who was 15 when Abraham died, continued this way of living until finally he and his sons went down to Egypt. And it would be 400 years or so before they came back to Canaan. And of course, they didn't come back. None of those people saw the fulfillment of God's promise that they would inherit the land. All of them lived as strangers in the land of promise. Verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Their lives remained uncomfortable all the way through. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had uncomfortable lives all the way through. Ever since they started following God, at least. The Hebrew Christians, well, in their times, in New Testament times, they felt like outsiders in their own society. Once they felt they'd belonged among the Jews, but now they were rejected both by the Romans and by their own people. And so the writer reminds them what it was like for Abraham. Abraham didn't feel at home. He didn't feel comfortable. What about us? Do you feel like an outsider sometimes at work or at school or in the society in your neighbourhood? You go to a club or you're socialising with friends, you're on the bus or you're on the train and you hear the conversations around you and you think, I'm a bit out of place here. What would these people really think if I told them what I really believe? What would they think of me? Well, if you're a Christian, you're an outsider now, as far as this world is concerned. Peter calls Christians sojourners, temporary residents, and exiles. 1 Peter 2, verse 11. And when we read Genesis, we can see that Abraham and Sarah, even though they had God's promises and they believed them, they had their struggles. Why was this? Well, it's because the situation that they were in at that time, that they could see and feel and touch, didn't yet reflect the promises of God to them. God had given them these promises, and yet the reality around them didn't match what God had said would happen to them and for them. God had promised that Abraham would inherit the whole land, and that in him all the nations on earth would be blessed. But here he was, living in tents, owning nothing, and still childless. And yet, through it all, Abraham and Sarah did believe God's promises. What they were living through was only temporary. God's promises were certain to be fulfilled. And it's like that for us too. Our life now is only a temporary state of affairs. People of faith are foreigners on earth. Finally, people of faith look forward to a city to come. Verses 10, 14, and 16. People of faith look forward to a city to come. Why was it that Abraham persevered? Why did he endure living in tents as an old man when he could have had a comfortable house in Ur or in Haran? Why did he stay as a foreigner in Canaan instead of enjoying life in Mesopotamia, and possibly the most pleasant and prosperous and fertile region on earth between those two great rivers of the Tigris and Euphrates, a place where he would have had access to rich treasures from across the world? We're told why he persevered in that lifestyle. Verse 10, for, here's the reason, for he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were quite open about it. They didn't feel at home in Canaan. They clearly weren't settled. In fact, they acknowledged openly, says that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, verse 13. It was obvious that they were still looking for a homeland. They hadn't arrived yet. Why? Why were they looking for a homeland? Because they knew that the Canaan of their present experience wasn't their home. And they endured this constant tension in their lives. Sometimes they were really scared. They feared for their lives. And it caused them, Abraham stumbled into sin, didn't he? Because he was afraid that they would kill him for the sake of Sarah. Sometimes they were living in fear of their lives. Isaac, too, had that same experience. There were arguments over wells. There were delicate negotiations with the Canaanites. Problems, as Ben was telling us this morning, over space for flocks, not just with Lot and Abraham, but with the residents of the land, the current possessors of the land at that time. So Abraham and Isaac and Jacob's minds were very much on their homeland. Where was this homeland then? They weren't at home in Canaan. Where was the homeland? Back in Haran, in northern Mesopotamia? Or was it even further back, in Ur, in southern Mesopotamia? Well, it was neither of those places, was it? What they were thinking of, those places, if they were thinking of those places as their homeland, they could easily have set out on camels, and in a few weeks they would have been back in those cities, either of those places. Verse 14. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they would have come out, they would have had opportunity to return. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob didn't hanker after going back to Ur. Their minds were set on a far better place. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were longing for their true home. Where was their true home? Verse 16. As it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob didn't seek their ultimate comfort and security in this present life, and nor should the Hebrew Christians, and nor should we. Again, the lesson is not that we shouldn't have houses or jobs or pursue our studies, but that we should remember that these things are only temporary. In the present world, we have no permanent home. Even when, finally, centuries later, Abraham's physical descendants did occupy Canaan, the promised land, it wasn't a permanent state of affairs. And the writer of the Hebrews has already pointed this out in chapter 4. He says, chapter 4, verse 8, for if Joshua had given them rest, if he'd taken them to their final destination, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains, therefore, a rest for the people of God. It's still ahead. It was still ahead for Abraham. It was still ahead for Joshua, even as they occupied the land of Canaan. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob knew that God's promises were more trustworthy than what they could see with their eyes. And that's what true faith is, isn't it? They lived in dependence on God for everything. And they knew that God had guaranteed to them a wonderful and glorious future. They knew that despite the delay that they were facing, they would one day receive their inheritance. Think about that. In fact, they expected uncomfortable lives because the rest of being at home in God's land was not yet They expected uncomfortable lives. Sometimes we have false expectations, don't we, about life, and we think because we have a high standard of living or whatever it is, we think we have a right to lots of comforts in this life. And maybe other Christians who are living in dire poverty don't struggle so much with that as we do. We come to have this expectation of a comfortable, pain-free life. But Abraham didn't. Isaac and Jacob didn't. They expected uncomfortable lives. The rest was in the future. The rest of being at home in God's land was still to come. But during their outwardly uncomfortable lives, they had this inner comfort that God would keep his promises. They weren't despairing. They were people of faith. Yes, they had their struggles, but they looked forward. Jesus said that Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. He didn't see it with his physical eyes, but he saw it by faith. He had every confidence that what God had promised would be fulfilled. And there was an amazing result of this demonstration of real faith in the lives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It says there in verse 16 at the end of the verse, "Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city." God delights in faith. He loves to see his children trusting him. And so God is not ashamed to be known as their God. He's not ashamed to be identified with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. When you think of Jacob in particular, the kind of man he was before grace really took hold of his life, then God not ashamed of Jacob? Well, he says he's not ashamed of Jacob because he trusted God. He is still today the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And remember, Jesus pointed out to the Jewish leaders, some of the Sadducees, he said, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living, Matthew 22, verse 32. Yes, although the bodies of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had long ago turned to dust, we don't know where they are, they themselves are still alive and even now are with Christ in heaven. So, have they reached their homeland? Have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob reached their homeland? As someone was asking you that question, you were giving a defense for your hope. What would you say? Have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob reached their homeland? Well, in a sense, yes, because they're in the presence of God. But in a sense, no, because they haven't yet entered into the fullness of their inheritance. How can that be? Well, it's because their inheritance and ours is an earthly inheritance as well as a heavenly one. The present state of believers in glory, even those that we know who've died and are with Christ, which is far better than being surrounded by all the pain and the sicknesses and so on in this life, their present state is not the final one. Yes, they're happy now. Yes, their painful toil and their suffering is over. But even now, for them, as well as for us, the best is yet to come. The writer, in fact, sums up at the end of chapter 11, verse 39. He says, all these, referring to everyone that he's talked about, having obtained a good testimony from God through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. In other words, we will all enter that blessing and that completeness of that inheritance together. The expectation of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob is what we look forward to also. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob will one day rise again. That's the hope of the Christian faith, the certain hope. It's not death and getting rid of bodies forever and living as spirits. No, it's resurrection bodies, new bodies, spiritual bodies that we will enjoy living in forever. Their expectation is our expectation. When Jesus comes back, he will bring Abraham and Isaac and Jacob with him. 1 Thessalonians 4:14, for if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. Now, three quotes from Psalm 37. No need to turn to it. You can look it up later. Three quotes from Psalm 37, verses 9, 11, and 22. Here they are. But those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. But the meek shall inherit the earth and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. For those blessed by him, by the Lord, shall inherit the earth, but those cursed by him shall be cut off. What did Jesus say? Matthew 5, verse 5. Blessed are the meek, those who've learned to trust God and not to trust their own wisdom. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, an inheritance to come for Christians. Remember the wonderful picture in Revelation 21? It's there that we find the city that God has prepared. It's been prepared in heaven, but it comes down to earth. God's dwelling place comes down to earth to be there forever. Not the world that we know and see with our eyes, a world of sin and suffering and death, but a world made new, a world redeemed, a world that has been restored as the creation groans for in Romans 8. A wonderful and beautiful world, a world better than the one that Adam and Eve lost. John says, God's dwelling place comes down from earth to be there forever. Remember that picture of the temple in the Old Testament? God's dwelling place among his people and how they had to be kept outside. Well, now God comes down to live among his redeemed people permanently, face to face. And they're no longer outside. There's no temple. He is with them. The Lord God and the Lamb are the temple, and we are face to face with him. John says, Revelation 21, verse 2, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle, the dwelling place of God, is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. That's the promise through the whole Old Testament, repeated over and over and over again, and fulfilled in that vision, in that picture that John saw. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Then he who sat on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, to John, Write, for these words are true and faithful. Abraham had God's words. He hung on to those words. We have more words than Abraham had to hang on to. Those words that God has given us are true and faithful. And what did Jesus say? He said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. That is Abraham's inheritance. That is ours. The city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light, and the nations who are in Abraham, who are in Christ, the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honour into it. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day. There shall be no night there. They shall bring the glory and the honour of the nations into it, but they shall by no means enter it. Anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. What a picture of that city to come that Abraham looked forward to by faith. What a wonderful place. Finally, Abraham and all God's redeemed people will feel at home. Finally, rest. Finally, that joyful freedom of serving God forever in perfect bodies. No more subject to sin, no more subject to disease, but with capabilities that we haven't even imagined to live for God in that new world. Well, people of faith leave their old life behind. People of faith are foreigners on earth. people of faith, look forward to a city to come. Are you a man, a woman, or a boy, or girl of faith? Is that true of you? May God help us to learn these things and to do them, to follow in Abraham's footsteps.